write it out just word for word. You can put it down in your shorthand. Now you have it on your mind. Now you, you've got your mind on what I'm telling you, talking to you about. Basically, you see, she is not a Puritan, and she never is a Puritan. Now, I told you Hawthorne was a historian, and he saw. Now, you listen to me. Don't look at the board. And he saw. Hawthorne, in his time, saw clearly that the first generation who came over from the old country, something happened to them over here. They were still continental people in the first generation. The second generation who were brought up here, they lacked something. And you see the contrast. Now this is in it. Now this is not Emerson. This is just plain history. You see it in those Puritan women. And then you see it as Hester, you see, as a person of great feeling and dignity and these other qualities. All of you know Hester, Portia, you see. And she's a great Renaissance lady. That's the reason I brought that in. Another point that was bothersome in our discussion was her acts of charity seemed to show that she was different from what Emerson and Thoreau said about acts of charity and benevolence and philanthropy. But we can work it out more. But so far as our discussion goes now, those acts of charity did never ally her with society. If anything, you see, they were acts of suffering. And the third point, I think this suffering ought to be there. Ought to be there very strong, and it's the suffering and the clash with society that emancipates her so that she is transformed from a person of feeling to a person of thought. Critics of the American mentality say that in our thinking, as in a presidential election, it's not thought, it's feeling. Now, I don't mean to tell you the first and last of that, you understand that. I'm just pursuing that thought. Now, if you follow through on it, if you keep Emerson in mind now, you see, what is it that Emerson has done? I think your clearest clue is that little passage in Signs of the Times at the end of the essay, the scholar, isn't it? In which he says, this is clearly a mark of our time that we pay attention to the commonplace, and not the faraway, and the elevated, and the noble. And along with that is the attention we give to a single individual. Now, here's the thing. It may be. Now, you watch this. I didn't mean, I'm not lecturing to you now. I just want to talk with you, actually. It may be that Hawthorne's choice of a Puritan subject has nullified his artistic effort. Because none of you penetrated and broke through into his thought. If you're not good readers, I don't know where we'd find them on the campus. Now, you say by rationalize it that if you lived in his time, you might catch it, but I don't think so. You've got more preparation now, critical preparation, than they have. Now, I wish you'd put these things down that I'm telling you. You see, artistically, he may have defeated himself by taking a Puritan subject and one of sin and that all that other stuff that we've talked about. Now, look at Dimmesdale. I have a number of passages, but we never did just stop on any particular one. You have to consider that his sermons, Dimmesdale, in that little section we were talking about, where it talks about the mentality of the Puritan ministers, and they had the highest mentality, you see, in the state at that time, that Dimmesdale was not a scholar, he was not saintly, but he had that one quality. You remember that? That his wound was kept raw. He had what you might call the, I hear critics now call it, that artistic imbalance which keeps him sensitive, you see, to what's going on. So that his sermons were a high point. Now, I think that's true of the period. I think Hawthorne practiced that, and he's speaking from his own experience. But I don't have to just pass on my views to you. I mean, I just want you to examine it. Now, that last part, I hope you have looked again and again now at his sermon, the Election Day sermon. That's one of the high points of the whole Emersonian period. It might be. Now, there is eloquence. There's the spoken word. There is elevation. Now, it doesn't last. Now, why doesn't it last? In other words, why did he perform like that and then go to pieces? As he's represented, you see, in the story. Now, you say Hester emancipated herself from society. In Dimmesdale's case, I think you don't have to say society. You see, he's in the grip, his thinking is in the grip of just one institution. Society, yes, but it's one institution. Now, that doesn't mean it's a church, and the church is something that we don't have anymore, or not anything like that. Any institution, I think he's trying to say. Now, look what the approach will do. Let me look at this. Now look at this. You carry it through into the others. Now look in Thoreau. As for men, they will hardly fail one anywhere. I had more visitors while I lived in the woods than in any other period of my life. Oh, damn. You read that woodchopper. Read it. Just word for word, and see that marvelous, illiterate fella come to life. Let me tell you, I've got to keep you just a minute now. I apologize. On Monday, I'll line out Poe for you, or try to get him in some terms where we can read him. Now, what I'd like for you to do for Monday, but you can't do it from one time to another, but you could do it by Wednesday, I wish you'd write me a term paper. And by term paper, I mean just what you've done this morning, except take more time and go into more detail. and allow your minds to work in these terms. Now listen to me, I know you're in a hurry. I've got to get up on the third floor, beat the freshman now. I don't know, this point we're in now, I don't know a more promising point of view. If you felt like this, Hilda, towards any of the people you worked with, you would write differently. You say you can't write. You can write. It's not your writing, it's your conception of people. You carry through in your paper this notion about we are free from the drudgery of the old cook stove, but we do not go towards the standard of excellence. But you can't work that out with any of your individuals because you don't feel that way towards individuals. Now you see, Thoreau can stop and let this poor old Canadian woodchopper come to life. If you could do that, you see, your writing would be different. I let her read her paper. It's a very fine one. I enjoyed it very much on some of her things. If she wants to, if she'd do it, I'd now, that's what I'd like for you to do. I'd like for you to take this thing here, our reinterpretation of these people. You've got Thoreau, Hawthorne, the first 150 pages of Moby Dick. That's a marvelous passage in Knights and Squires. And don't you know what? I'm keeping you overtime. I realize it. I'm nervous, too. Don't you know what Melville said, or Ishmael said, in one of those two chapters, Knights and Squires? He says nobility is no longer a matter of investing with robes. You remember that passage? That's pure Emerson, pure Thoreau. And that changes your whole attitude towards them, and it could be towards what you do now. You see what my intention is. The rest of your life, Hester Prynne, and these Knights and Squires, and Thoreau of Walden will be just a part of your thought. Now, you won't remember me. You may not remember each other. But you won't let these go. This is a new world, a new view of life. And I want you to write me, just start with that thesis, that this is a whole thing reinterpreted. And I'll see you next time. Huh? Now, this is on Monday, Emerson, on Monday, February 12, 68. Monday, it's on Monday, on the 12th of February. What I had in mind, what I said to him was that their quiz papers on Friday sounded more like they ought to sound. And I just didn't know who they were responding to because I'd explained a good bit to them. Now that's Carrie. Karen wants me to explain exactly what Emerson meant.
You just read a little bit of him. You think you read enough?
Little girl.
what you'd want to do is read a book on Emerson in order to get his viewpoint. You don't want to take his word for it. You want to go to the library. Well, that's a fair question. You see, I've done that 6 times already. You want me to just open up for every class with a little summation of the Emersonian viewpoint? You know, I was just sitting over there waiting for the bell to ring. I was just thinking. Ishmael would you make a statement about Ishmael? Say something, if I can get into it, that'll give us something to go on. If I just say yes, that's fine. I agree with that. Let it go. We've got nothing to go on, understand? But anybody can say that, whether read Emerson or not. Or Hawthorne or Thoreau. Kind of isolates himself. Now finish my thought for me. Do you think of Ishmael out there as like the role at Walter? That little harder. You say, is he like the Lord Walden when Ishmael, when he's out on that whaling ship? Uh, You can make a firmer statement about that. Now, in that passage I read to you a little bit about the created woodchop, you know, he starts off by saying, out there I had some more visitors than I ever had before. Now, you have visitors, so to speak, in Moby Dick. In the first 150 pages, you have people. Huh? You say these things, don't make me say them, and I'll pick them up. Uh-huh. A little tied down, as you say out there. But now, I think there's a more obvious statement about Ishmael, a much more obvious statement, where it's not really the sea. Who do you see in the first 150 pages? Who else? Why? Mates, and who else? Yes, that curious fella. Yeah. Who else, you see? Right quick. Who is that? Yeah, buddy. What about? Do you see him that tail end? I mean, it's end. Who are they? Yes. Now look at here. The reason I asked you to read that was, you have a gallery of individuals, just one rich individual after another. And it looks to me like without this Emersonian lift, you'll flatten them all. I'd say a person almost has to read to say the first part of this now. As if it is an answer to a promise. It's a fulfillment of the promise. Great expectations are in it. Now, let me read it a little bit in that light, and you say, what is Emerson? Now, it's in the swing. It's in the swing. Now, call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never matter how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particularly there to me on shore, I thought I'd sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating circulation whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth. You see, that's just the, I don't know. Why do we read like that? The ear has no part in our reading. We don't hear it. No part at all. You see, that first line, that first phrase, it just echoes ever since. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It's a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Now, here's a man who's talking to you. You come up there and raise a question, and he's telling you, and he takes his time. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, Whenever it's a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I count it high time go to the sea. Now, when I say that I'm in the habit of going to sea, whenever I begin to grow hazy about the eyes and to be over conscious of my lungs, I do not mean to have it inferred that I ever go to sea as a passenger. For to go as a passenger, you must needs have a purse. And this purse is but a rag unless you have something in it. Besides, passengers grow seasick. They get quarrelsome. They don't sleep at night. They don't enjoy themselves much, as a general thing. No, I never go as a passenger. Nor, though I am something of a sort, do I ever go to sea as a commodore, or a captain, or a cook. I abandon the glory and distinction of such offices to those who like them. For my part, I abominate all honorable, respectable toils, trials, tribulations of every kind whatsoever. It is quite as much as I can do to take care of myself without taking care of the ships, box, brigs, schooners, and whatnot. And as for going as cook, though I confess there's considerable glory in it, a cook being a sort of officer on shipboard, yet somehow I never fancied broiling fowl. Though once broiled, judiciously buttered, and judgmatically salted and peppered, there's no one will speak more respectfully, not to say reverentially, of a broiled fowl than I will. No, when I go to sea, I go as a simple sailor, right before the mast, plumb down in the forecastle, and aloft there to the royal masthead. True, they rather order me about and make me jump from spar to spar like a grasshopper in a May meadow. And at first, this sort of thing is unpleasant enough. It touches one's sense of honor, particularly if you come of an old established family in the land, the Van Rensselaers, the Randolphs, the Hardy Canutes. And more than all, if just previous to putting your hand in the tarbox pot, you've been lording it as a country schoolmaster, making the tallest boys stand in awe of you. The transition is a keen one, I assure you, from a schoolmaster to a sailor, and requires a strong concoction of Seneca and the Stoics to enable you to grin and bear it. But even that wears off in time. Now, what of it? If some old hunks of a sea captain orders me to get a broom and sweep down the decks, what does that indignity amount to weight, I mean, in the scales of the New Testament? Do you think the Archangel Gabriel will think the less of me for that? Because I promptly and respectfully obey that old hunk in that particular instance. Who ain't a slave? Tell me that. Well then, however the old sea captains may order me about, However they may thump and punch me about, I have the satisfaction of knowing that it is all right. That everybody else, in one way or other, is served in much the same way, either in a physical or a metaphysical point of view, that is. And so the universal thump is passed around, and all hands should rub each other's shoulder blades and be content. That's the road taken so much farther. And Hawthorne never reached this point. I see. Just pure. Don't let me put the lid on the box. To me now, it's these points that you bring up. It seems to me like this is just the answer, just the whole answer to all those questions. Go ahead, Ms. Day. Yes, the officers. Now, this is embodied, you see, and there's absolutely no theory here. But you see, when Hawthorne wrote Scarlet Letter, and he wrote this, they lived together and talked all through the night. Just talked and talked, the two of them. Side of that was respectability. And he stayed away from respectability. Oh, he just stays away from it.
That's Hemingway. I brought that in.
No. It's a view of life that he's permitted to have. It has to be. I see Hemingway branches off of Twain. I can read you passages in Twain that sound very much like Ishmael. Innocence. Not innocence, but Overland Journey. What does he call it? Across the country? The Overland Trail? Roughing it. Roughing it, he starts off on that old mail coach, dangling his feet and looking out over the plateau. There, he said, it was sort of sharp. You can read the 19th century without Emerson. But it opens it. Now, you've got to consider this. We don't feel this way now. Why? I can show you a sudden, catastrophic end, just like an earthquake. You think all good things are here. They have it. And then all at once it comes to a violent end. Violent end. And I'll show it to you. Well, people just simply can't think like this anymore. Even when they try. Their community thoughts take over. They're actually thinking about togetherness, you see. You've opened the question. I wouldn't try to settle it, you know. I think you have to live with questions like that. Ishmael shows that, at least in his case, he doesn't have to go around rebelling against society with a chip on his shoulder in order to remain an individual. I don't know. Emerson didn't. I told you that. I read in the book. The only time he actually clashed was in the divinity school address. They didn't invite him back, you see, for a generation. But he didn't. You know, he tells you. He tells you he can live in harmony with his environment. He doesn't clash. Except mentally. To himself. In his thought. Oh. You mean inwardly, clash?
No, I mean what I said.
Now, let me tell you what I. You see, the book says, the schedule says, we go on now and read another writer. Quit this and go on. Now, I have found, though, that Poe interrupts everything. It's impossible to carry any of these thoughts over into Poe. You see, he's got that strong, gothic, where they're out on these ships, no telling where, and one plunges down on the other one, and this man jumps over on the other ship. Things that never happen. He's got so much of that. So that what you're doing is in a land of, my words don't come to me. You're in this land of Gothic, I call it, and you're constantly trying to make some meaning. You're struggling for meaning. And your struggles are against it. It's too much for you. You can't do it. If I tell you a little meaning, you won't believe it. I think this is the best I ever saw. I didn't realize just how well you could go into... Well, you see, they wrote them together. Both of them are thinking somewhat in the same terms. They're pursuing somewhat the same thoughts. Melville and Hawthorne in these two books. You see, Poe clashes. He's an interruption. Now, I tell you, I believe, you know, I told today I'd line out Poe for you. I think I won't. I think I'll just leave him for a while. What we ought to do, I don't think you're tired of this sort, are you? You don't look tired. After all, you see, you've got your mental muscles, you've got mental muscles. You've read a lot, you've had this universal thumb passed around yourselves, a good many of you, that he talks about here. You see, don't forget that thump he talks about, and the universal thump is passed around. He gets it. But the chief one in this, in Moby Dick, who gets it is Ahab. Ahab is the one who struggles. Now, what I didn't give you an extra assignment today. I wanted you to write that paper. And by writing the paper, I mean take some little view of this, reinterpret it, and show the elevation of the individual. That's theme enough, you know. The less thought you have, the better. The less thesis you have, the better. But what you want to do is examine the material. Now, you see, inevitably, as you think of Ishmael, see, he's new to you, And he ought to be, he's fascinating. And you won't know all about Ishmael, but you don't want to put your time in reading Ishmael. You see, that'll divert you. Just hold off a little bit. Just take the first 150 pages and let go of that. With what you already know about Ishmael. And then you see, he's in the same company as Hester. See, these years ago, when you first got acquainted with Hester, you never thought that she'd occupy your thought, really. And that she could think. You never realized that. And you see, now if you don't watch out, she'll be one of your milestones. She'll stay in your mind. Along with Thoreau. Now, that's not all of Thoreau. That's just Thoreau of Walden. And I think we ought to sort of say that, make that clear. We're just talking about Thoreau of Walden. Now, in a way, they all are at Walden, but the circumstances all differ. You see, you say Thoreau went out for this purpose. You say Ishmael went out for the same purpose on the ship, but it doesn't work that way. And that's one of the things, you see, about the Emersonian view, which they... It's not a systematic view of the world. It's an inquiry. You see, whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather mortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must inquire. That's the big word, you see. He must inquire if it be goodness. So that what Ishmael does, you see, is, and this is a conventional thing, this is the big industry, whaling in Nantucket and up in there, as he tells you here. Really, you see, in Ishmael, it's an inquiry. So Melville has an inquiry against the background of the industry that people are engaged in, the big one, one of the big ones. And certainly, as we say, a romantic industry. Nothing, you see, going to the moon, it really doesn't compare with it. Now that's curious. Now you see, this thing works so many ways. You say, now I can appreciate going to the moon better now. It too is an inquiry. If you could take the view of that, as Ishmael does, you see, of his whaling voyage. And if Thoreau does his tour at Walden and Hester, now you see that company, that's a new company. You see, it's a whole new view. It's almost regeneration. See, what happened to Paul on the road to Damascus? What is the word for that? Illumination. Huh? Illumination? Yes. Revelation. It's almost revelation. It's a new world, you see, that you enter it. And it's such a fine world. Small parts of it, you see. Here, all these trades, and he said, when he was putting up his chimney, he studied masonry. You remember that? Well, you know, you could do the same thing. You can follow in Thoreau's tracks. I remember when I started ranching down here, I didn't know how to build a gate. And I went around the countryside looking for these gates to find one of the right kind of gates. Well, I saw gates everywhere. I just dreamed about gates there for a while. That's visible, something visible. Now that's one quality of their world, is visible, and you see, once you get into the world of Pierre Elliott, there's nothing visible any longer. It's an abstract world. It's the world of the intellect. Footnotes, documentation. Now, let me tell you, the only thing I think you need to worry about, you don't need to worry about anything, but you think you do. You see, if you could do a little bit like they do, if you could sort of get a hold of the idea and let the idea carry you along. You see, you want a logical arrangement. You want a systematic view of Emerson and then set it down on all these other things. If you could just get a sort of feel for Emerson and then go ahead through these other things. Feeling is stronger than the mind, you see. Feeling. Oh, you've got so much to consider. And don't forget that little point I brought to you out of Moses from an Old Man, where Hawthorne gives you, puts you on the wrong direction. Here's flowers, you see, are pale. They have bloomed in too retired a shade. I don't know anything that is more deceptive, actually deceptive, than those words of Hawthorne. And since then, writers realize that, and they try not to picture themselves. Just let their book stand up. Because, you see, Hawthorne, any of it, but this one in particular, Scarlet Letter, is just volcanic. Oh, parts of that, you see, are just explosive. And here we just read it down, make it mild and gentle and fragrant, and something that came out of the old Puritans gone to seed. That's the way it works. Oh, there's so many hurdles, you see, that trip a person intellectually. Oh, it's hard to be an intellectual. As Governor Wallace said last night on PBL, he respected the intellectuals, but there were so many who were just pseudo-intellectuals. Well, it's hard to be the real thing. So many things to trip you. Now, I get off the subject. What I was going to say, I just wanted to... you see, now let me see. Well, you see, I'm sort of into this thought now, and I can't get out of it. I think you want to consider a little of the doctrine, so to speak, Emersonian principle, theory. You see, Emerson is a great theorist. And without his theory, you couldn't understand Thoreau. And I'll tell you, I saw this last time, didn't have a chance to pass it on to you. It won't take just a second. Now, this is that package on I know you can find these things, the Canadian Witch Hopper. Look at this sentence. As for men, they will hardly fail one anywhere. It's hard for me to realize that there's such a strong Emersonian statement in Thoreau. As for men, they will hardly fail one anywhere under these favorable conditions. I had more visitors while I lived in the woods than I did any other time. I met several there under more favorable circumstances than I could anywhere else, and fewer came on trivial business. Who should come to my lodge this morning but a true Homeric man? Now you pick it up and read it there. I'll just say a few words of it and just to recall it to you. A Canadian, a woodchopper and postmaker, who can hold 50 posts in a day, who made his last supper on a woodchuck that his dog caught. Now he too has heard of Homer. And, as he said, if it were not for books, I'd not know what to do on rainy days. So Thoreau comments, you see, though perhaps he has not read one wholly through for many rainy seasons. Now, some priest who could pronounce the Greek itself taught him to read the verse in his testament in his native parish far away.
And now I must translate to him while he holds the book. Achilles' reproof of Patroclus for his sad countenance. Why are you in tears, Patroclus, like a young girl? And he says, that's good. He has a great bundle of white oak bark under his arm for a sick man. Gathered this Sunday morning. I suppose there's no harm in going after such a thing today, he says. Now he was cast in the coarsest mold. A stout but sluggish body, yet gracefully carried, was a thick, sunburnt neck, dark, bushy hair, girl's sleepy blue eyes, which were keenly lit up with expression. He wore a flat gray cloth cap, a dingy wool-colored greatcoat, and cowhide boots. And he was a great consumer of meat, usually carrying his dinner to work a couple of miles past my house, for he chopped all summer in a tin pail. Cold meats, often cold woodchucks, and coffee in a stone bottle which dangled by a string from his belt. Now, he was a skillful chopper and indulged in these flourishes of his trade. You see, that's Franklin and Thoreau. Such an exuberance of animal spirit had he that he sometimes tumbled down and rolled on the ground with laughter at anything which made him think and tickle. Now, just read it all and just dwell on it. And I will tell you what happened. I don't know anyone who could read that, like I said to you, and get anything at all that Thoreau has in mind without this long Emersonian background. What invariably happens is, from my point of view, is we say that Thoreau is patronizing, condescending. We say that Thoreau is condescending towards the woodchopper. Now, here's the thing. We ourselves wouldn't stop and look at a man like that. He's coarse. He's almost a tramp. But what Thoreau is talking about is that a man will hardly ever fail you in the right circumstances. And he gets an extreme case of it. And we argue with his example and forget his precept. And that happens again and again. We argue with people's examples and let muff their precept. That puts life into the world, you see. And all this portrait of gallery of portraits that Emerson does, they all have this genius. Now, that's what I would say to you. I would indulge a little bit in the Emersonian theory, but I wouldn't let it weigh me down. I just use it to where it will help me and help open these things up. Now, there are things that I ought to say to you just easily. Last time I put it on the board. If you set down my notes, that's the way I would do it. You see, I would take this new view of Hesper. Now, one thing that will help you pay for so much is to remember your old view. And just admit it. Don't try to cast it off like an old shell, you see, your old view. Live with it. It'll give piquancy. It'll give point to your new view. Of Hester, of Dimmesdale. Now, several of you said yesterday that he was depressed. Dimmesdale was depressed or depraved. I forget the word we used. Well, I see I'm not extending your reading. You're just working on material you've already read. I'm just allowing a little time for you to do this. I wonder today. I'll take it on Wednesday. And I don't like this little bitty old page or two. You don't get enough information in it. I like for you to give a little sweep to your papers. Once your mind starts, just don't stop them. Don't boil it down. I don't want to boil down stuff. I want your mind as it works. I don't want the products of your thought. That's not worth a hoot. I don't want the results and conclusions and opinions, you see. I want the process by which you... I want you considering, Hester. Take a letter, sweep. Well, now, you see, if you do everything I ask you to do, you won't finish for Christmas. But, there's no harm. Now, you think just a minute, and let me check the roll. What is today, the 12th?
A person with Emerson's background who says that mean that never before had that been true. So in all your literature classes, you have not had, at least in Emerson's sense, an interest in a single person. Now that may not, work out. Now let's talk just a little bit so I won't talk too much. Now that'll carry you through the whole paper. If you add to that what Emerson says at the beginning, you see, Rousseau would be a man, must be a nonconformist. He was who would gather mortal palms, must inquire, you see, must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but inquire if they be good. So it is that search that you see in the writer and in Hester. It is that search which goes along with the individual with a single person. Now that's enough to carry you through the material. Now you haven't said a word. Now inquiring. You mean what is the object of an inquiry? And chapter 13. You say what do you mean?
She tossed it to me, and I'm trying to toss it to her.
How else would you put it? Help her out. Now, don't waste somebody else. You've got these things on your mind. Don't let me
suffer. She uses the word, she finds her identity. Going against her own inner feelings in the adultery.
It's enough to have an eye there and keep on trying. I can't carry you that far. Nothing that way. I don't think it comes up in that way. That she ever passed a judgment on whether she's right or wrong. Yes. I call her that. Brings it up. She never apologizes. She never timid. And Emerson says most people are timid and apologetic. So that's sort of Emersonian attitude there, isn't it? Yes. Now, you can approach that a little different way. You don't have to go entirely through